Okay, Parashat Vayishlach, and we'll start as we always like to, right at the very, very beginning. We've seen some of the themes previously, but hopefully a different take on them. Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim Lefanav. So Yaakov sent Malachim before him, ahead of himself, El Esav Achiv, to Esav his brother, Artsa Seir Sede Edom, to the land of Seir, to the field of Edom. So I deliberately didn't translate the word Malachim. So if you look at Rashi says, Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim, Malachim Mamash. That's literally, it was angels. That's, we know that the word Malachim, Malach, can have a dual meaning. It can sometimes mean an angel, and sometimes it can mean a messenger. So here, that's Rashi's telling us that it means, based on the Medrash, it means actual angels. A number of the commentaries on Rashi, you know, wonder why does Rashi want to diverge from what would be the Pshat. The Pshat would be that, you know, since it doesn't mention anything to do with a miracle, that, you know, we'd always assume that, you know, unless we have to believe otherwise, we'd assume that it's what it says it is. That's why do I have to assume that it means angels rather than messengers? So some of the super commentaries on Rashi point out, look at back at the very end of last week's parasha. The very end of last week's parasha was Vayif Yaakov halach ledarko, Vayif ge'uvo malachei Elokim. The end of last week's parasha was that angels of Hashem encountered Yaakov, and now we have two psukim later the word malach. We can legitimately assume that it means the same form of malach at the end of the previous parasha. The end of the previous parasha was angels, so here also it means angels. Having said that, let's look at the Radak, who interprets it differently. And the Radak says, Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim, that's, so Yaakov sent angels, or sent Malachim, Afal Pishivticha Kel Kama Pamim, even though Hashem had assured him on numerous occasions that all would be well, Hayam Fached Me'achiv, he was still frightened of his brother, they weren't on the best of terms, understatement. That's when they parted ways 20 years previously. They were on bad terms. That's, and Yaakov Avinu, even though Hashem had told him, don't worry, everything will be all right, you know, you've got my assurance that I will guard you wherever you go, nevertheless, Yaakov was worried that perhaps he'd been sinful in some way and therefore was going to suffer as a result. So he sent men from his, messengers from his men, so they could try and butter Esav up a bit. So what we've got here is a machloket between Rashi and Radak, whether it was real angels or whether it was people as messengers. That's Rabbeinu Bechaya actually wants to grasp the rope at both ends and says it's both. Look at what Rabbeinu Bechaya says. Milat Malachim kolelet hashluchim bivnei adam u'malachei hasharet hashluchim meit HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So as we know, the term Malachim can include, that's what can refer to, either that's angels or to messengers. U'mipnei she Yaakov hutzrach lalechet lefadan Aram, and seeing as Yaakov had to go to Panadan Aram mipnei pachad Esav Achiv, because he was frightened of his brother, that's where he'd been the past 20 years, Al-Kain b'kesh atah b'shuvoy l'artzor, therefore when he returned now to his land, he wanted lahaniach chamat Achiv, to calm down his brother's anger, v'lidrosh Shlomo, and to inquire after his welfare, be nice to him. So he sent messengers, avadav anshei beitom, members of his household. V'shalachim ahem min ha-malachim shepagu bo, And he also sent with them some of the angels that encountered him in last week's Sedra. So Rabbeinu Bechai is saying it's both. It wasn't just angels, as Rashi's having us believe. It wasn't just messengers, as the Radak's having us believe. It was both. He sent messengers, and those messengers were to be guarded by divine angels. So that's the angels or messengers that Yaakov sent at the beginning. He didn't just send these malachim, but he gave them instructions. Vayetzavotam lemor, he commanded them thusly, Kol tomrun ladoni leisav, this is what you should say to my master Esav, Kol amar avdecha Yaakov, this is what your servant Yaakov says, Im lavan garti, I lived with Lavan, Vaichar adata, and I've tarried or delayed, stayed there till now. So as an aside, and we're not going to deal with this in any depth tonight, but as an aside, one of the things that is very, very striking about this this first part of the Sedra is Yaakov's subservient attitude towards his brother. That's Yaakov Avinu is coming back to some degree with his head between his tail between his legs. That's, you know, he's not marching in saying, I'm the one with the brachot, I'm, you know, superior to you. He's coming along and he's, you know, calling Esav Adoni, referring to himself as a servant. We see he's going to send gifts to his brother, that he bows to his brother. So it's an interesting, result to, you know, everything that he was promised in the brachot by Yitzchak all those years ago at Yavducha Amim Vishtachavu Lechalu Umim Hevegve Lachecha Vishtachavu Lechabene Imecha, you know, that your brothers are going to bow down to you. But in actual fact, what Yaakov is doing is he's coming almost apologetically for what's happened, and saying, you know, I'm bowing down to you, I'm your servant. So that's very, very interesting attitude of Yaakov.
Imagine then, anyway, Yaakov has got malachim, angels, at his beck and call. Hashem, we learn Hashem has angels for certain purposes. And we'll say, Yaakov just sending out angels.
Okay, so I mean that would perhaps support the position of the Radak that, yeah, why did he need angels at this point in time? I mean, what I think we understand from last week's parasha is that, you know, at the beginning of Vayetzeh, Yaakov Avinu encounters angels as he's leaving Eretz Israel. Now he's returning to Eretz Israel, so again he's getting those angels of Eretz Israel back. That seems to be really what's happening. So, you know, in a Vayetzeh context, it's just, you know, the angels that accompanied him in Eretz Israel left him when he left Eretz Israel, and now they're reassociating with him. In a Vayishlach context, saying he's got, you know, the angels have come. Oh, Shalom Aleichem, welcome back. That's what's happened at the end of last week. Well, they're here, the angels, so, you know, may as well send them to Esav. But I mean, you know, those mefarshim who want to say that it was messengers, one of their challenges is, like, why should it be angels? What does angels are there for emergency situations, for when a miracle is required. There's no miracle required here. It's not an emergency situation. I mean, you know, it's a bit tense and everything, but, you know, Hashem doesn't, as you say, doesn't just send angels around, you know, every time there's a bit of tension between brothers. So
even if he does, not that Yaakov's beck and call. He doesn't know.
Correct. So, okay, so that's a good kasha. That's against those who say that it's Malachim Mamash. Anyhow, let's look at what must be the most famous Rashi on the Sedra, where Yaakov says in Lavan Garti, I lived with Lavan Garti, lo naaseti sar v'chashuv, I wasn't anybody important there, el ager, I was just a stranger, temporary stranger, Ein chakadai lishno ati al bichot avi chasheh baruchayni hever givila achecha. That's, you don't need to worry about hating me for the brachot that I got. That, oh, you'll be stronger than your brother. Shari lunit kaima be, I'm no stronger than you. You know, you've got the army. I haven't got the army. That's, don't worry. It's, all this trouble that we had was a waste of time. The brachot didn't help me at all. I've been knocking around for 20 years. And I don't have much to show for it. That's one answer. Davar acher, another answer. Garti b'gematria taryag. So the gematria of Garti is, it's not just gematria, but it's an anagram of taryag. 613. Kolomar im lavan harasha garti. I lived with the wicked lavan, but taryag mitzvot shamarti, and I observed the 613 mitzvot. And I didn't learn from his evil deeds. So a question which people ask on Rashi is, like, why on earth was Yaakov saying that to his brother Esav? We can understand the first answer in Rashi, okay, that he's saying, no, I was just a ger, I wasn't Sarvachashuv, I wasn't anybody important. Now we can understand why he's saying that to his brother. Okay, but why would he be coming back to his brother? His brother's not from. He hasn't seen his brother for 20 years. And the first thing he says is, oh, I want you to know, you know, we fell out 20 years. I want you to know I'm still as from as I used to be, and my beard's even longer. That's, you know, Esav's going to say, oh, thank you for telling me. We're really going to get on now. You know, cut out your from kite. That's so what's going on here? Look at Rav Moshe Feinstein in Darash Moshe. So he quotes the Rashi, Garati Bigamatria Taryag, Taryag Mitzot Shamati, Nirad Tahu Tanai. It seems that what Yaakov was doing was laying down conditions. Shamar La Esav, he was telling Esav, Sheyidah Shehu Ishishmo B'cholaz Mane'im. He's somebody who under all circumstances will observe the mitzvot. V'imrot Tse La'asot Shalom B'ofen Zeh, Yidaberi Mo Shalom. If these are the terms under which Esav wants to establish a peace treaty, then all well and good. V'im lo yaskim ela b'ofen sheyitarvu imo, but if he will only agree on the understanding there's going to be assimilation between the two sides, ein daber klal b'dvar shalom, then, you know, we've got nothing to talk about. So what Rav Moshe Feinstein says was, Yaakov Avinu was laying his cards on the table at the very outset. You know, I'm happy to have a certain relationship with you on my terms. My terms are, I was from in Lavan's house, and I'm going to be from back home. That's, if you can live with that, then all well and good. But if you can't, then I'm not interested. So he's really identifying. Of course, Esav, you know, wasn't interested. You know, had Yaakov done my machronim and had his suits checked for shatnas while he was away from home or not, that didn't really interest Esav. Right? But what he wanted Esav to know was what type of person he was. In terms of, Esav might have thought, okay, he's been away from home for 20 years. He's out of dad's house, not going to be from. That's no. He's saying, I've been from all this time, and those are the conditions, terms under conditions, under which I return. So that's Rav Moshe Feinstein. Let's look at a Chatam Sofer. So the Chatam Sofer says, look carefully at the Lashon of Rashi. Peirush Rashi, Taryag Mitzvot, Shamarti. I guarded the 613 mitzvot. Nired v'diu kamar tariyag mitzvot shamarti. It seems that he deliberately used that lashon of shamarti. She'im omnam kiyem hakol. Even if he, let's say, he kept all 613 mitzvot. L'chol ha'pachot mitzvot kibud avayim lo haya mekayim. He certainly couldn't be mekayim the mitzvah of kibud avayim. Couldn't fulfill the mitzvah of honoring his parents because his parents weren't there. Even if we say he could have observed all the other mitzvot. Mikol makom, nevertheless, haya omeidu mitzapeh mai tavo liyado. He was matai tavo liyado. That's, he was waiting to see when will he have the opportunity to do this mitzvah. V'uchal l'kaimon, I'll be able to fulfill it. Okay, it should have said, or I would have expected to say, tariyag mitzvot kiyamti. I observed the Tariyak Mitzvot. But he didn't observe the Tariyak Mitzvot. So therefore it says, Shamarti Dugmat Vaviv Shamayit HaDavar. In Parshat Vayeshev, when Yosef tells his brothers the dreams, right, and he tells them to his father, so we find that the brothers don't like him for it, Vaviv Shamar Et HaDavar. But his father, Rashi explains, kept an eye on the situation. Didn't say yeah, he didn't say no. I mean, he... More than that, he was looking forward to the day when these things would become true. It wasn't true now, but he hoped that it would become true at some stage in the future. That's Vaviv Shamar Et HaDavar. So Tariyak Mitzvot Shamarti means I waited for the opportunity to do the Tariyak Mitzvot. For Diyotor Bazesh Ikuvoit and Lavan Hayakashalav. This way he was telling Esav that the fact that he was trapped with Lavan for all this time, that was actually difficult for him. And that's why he's using the Lashon of Tariyag Mitzvot Shamarti. Now, an interesting question, which is addressed by a number of the Mepharshim, interestingly, is how can Yaakov Avinu says he keeps Tariyag Mitzvot? He can't keep all Tariyag Mitzvot. That man can't keep a mitzvah to do with a woman. That the non-king can't keep a mitzvah to do with a king. The non-kohen can't keep a mitzvah to do with a kohen. How can he say that he kept a tariyag mitzvot? So, in common parlance, we would say, yeah, you know, that's, you ask about, well, does he keep tariyag mitzvot? That's, yeah, he keeps tariyag mitzvot. It just means, is he frum? You know, does he keep all the mitzvot that he can? But none of them are farashim. You know, really take it seriously. And the Divrei David, one of the commentaries on Rashi, asked this question of Yesh Makshim at the end of the first line. Hayach HaShalakayim Kol Tariyag Mitzvot. How can you possibly keep all 613 mitzvot? V'halo Yesh Beinahem Mitzvot Hano HaGot L'chal Yisrael K'gon HaKamat Melech U'vinyan Beit HaMikdash. There's some which need the whole Jewish community building a Beit HaMikdash, appointing a king. You can't just do that by yourself. So our answer must be, Damrinam Bimnachot, it's Gemara Masechet Menachot, Kol Halseit B'Torat Korbanot, Kilu Hikrivotam. Anybody who is involved in learning the laws of the Korbanot, it's as if they've offered them up. Hachinami Kamar. So here also, this is essentially what Yaakov was saying, Shasakti B'Torat Shel Kol HaMitzvot, Fava Kilu Kiyamtim. I observed, you know, I learned the parashiyot of all the mitzvot, and it's as if I observed them. So in any event, that takes us, you know, back to the, you know, old question of what does it mean that the Avot learnt about all the mitzvot or observed all the mitzvot. And then another question which is asked by some of the Mepharshim on Rashi is, hold on, how can Yaakov Avinu say, I kept Tariyag Mitzvot when he married two sisters? That's against the Tariyag Mitzvot. So again, there's, you know, lots of creative answers to that question.
I'm just surprised that none of them also mentioned that some of the mitzvahs can only be kept in Israel.
Yeah.
That was like, of all the other things that I thought they would go through, one of the ones would have been an obvious one is, you're not even in Israel, there's no way you could have kept those cultural laws.
That's... it's always one of these questions on Rashi that, you know, in terms of, you know, generally we believe that Rashi is very medakdek in his lashon. You know, he doesn't say something if he doesn't mean it. But, you know, this is a question when he says, you know, he's looking at the lashon, you know, garati, oh, that's tariyag. Right? So it fits very nicely to say tariyag mitzvot shamarti. That's, you know, it's impossible for anybody to observe all 613. So I would have thought, you know, if I see Shamarti Tariyag Mitzvot, means that you know, I kept associated with all the mitzvot. That's I did the ones that I can do, and I was alert to the others as well. Yeah, I don't think it necessarily means, you know, more than that. It's always of interest, the effort that some of the commentaries put into picking these phrases, you know, apart. That's when I think it's conceivable to suggest that actually, you know, Rashi didn't mean anything more than pshut or shel mikra. You know, Tariyag Mitzvot meant, you know, kept the Torah.
And also, that's the second Rashi. The first Rashi is not even that.
Yep.
is Davar Acher.
I mean, also, always, whenever you got to Davar Acher, you need to ask what was wrong with the first. With the first Rashi. And when you got the second, what was wrong with the... You know, what was wrong with the second, that he needed the first. Anyhow, I want us to look at a passage from Rav Soloveitchik. Very, very thought-provoking on this expression. Im Lavan Gauti, Jacob was taken away from his parental home and experienced a long night of darkness, misery and distress. He was burdened with the mission of proving to the world that the covenantal community was capable of practicing Abraham's unique moral code by living a life of saintliness, not only in the promised land, but in exile far from the hills and valleys of Hebron and Shechem. I think we saw this idea last week as well. If I'm not mistaken, I think we saw it with Rav Soloveitchik, that part of the reason why Yaakov Avinu went into Galut was to show that the Torah isn't limited only to Eretz Yisrael, and that the Torah can be observed, and that we saw this notion of Yaakov building up his family. Maybe it was Rav Hirsch who said this. I can't remember if it was Rav Soloveitchik or Rav Hirsch. I have to check the handouts from last week. That Yaakov built his family in Galut to show that the Jewish family isn't limited to Eretz Yisrael. Otherwise, when we're sent into Galut, we would have this sense that Judaism can't exist outside of Eretz Yisrael. No, Judaism was built, the Jewish people was built outside of Eretz Yisrael. And here Rav Soloveitchik is saying that, part of the reason why Yaakov was in Galut was to show that you can have that community, the covenantal community, at in Chutz La'aretz. Im Lavan Garti, I've sojourned with Lavan, yet I observed the 613 mitzvot. Jacob stayed with Laban for 20 years, enough time to settle down and become a citizen of Haran and to consider himself a veteran resident of Haran. He should have said, Im Lavan Yashavti, I've settled with Laban. But he said, Garti, sojourned. He felt a stranger in Haran, the ways his son Joseph later felt a stranger in Egypt. He had not assimilated. He had not integrated himself into Laban's society and community. He had not accepted their morals, their code of ethics, or their lifestyle. He sojourned in Haran for a long time, yet he preserved his moral religious identity, his commitment to the God of Abraham, his commitment to the way of life that the God of Abraham sanctioned, his commitment to the promised land. All those commitments and many more were not affected at all. Jacob was as dedicated at the end of his 20 years of servitude in Laban's house as he was that first night he spent on the cold stones in Bethel when he pledged, the Lord will be my God. At the completion of his sojourn in Haran, the angel of God revealed himself to Jacob, I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a monument, where you pronounced me a vow. In other words, you remain loyal to your spiritual heritage and faith in me. Now he's going to compare Yaakov's experience in Chutz La'aretz with Yosef's experience. Joseph was burdened with a similar task. He again had to prove that Abraham's covenant could be practiced outside the promised land, that the moral laws are not contingent upon geography and chronology. The difference between Jacob's and Joseph's assignments is a dual one, and this is very interesting. First, Jacob had to prove that the Torah is realizable in poverty and oppression, that the immigrant, no matter how hard he has to work for a livelihood, no matter how poor and oppressed, is capable, if he makes up his mind, to give devotion and loyalty to his ancestral tradition. Joseph's mission was to demonstrate that enormous success, unlimited riches, admiration, prominence, and power are not in conflict with a saintly covenantal life. The immigrant, no matter what his destiny turns out to be, glorious success or miserable failure, can, if he possesses the heroic quality of either Jacob or Joseph, attend to his commitment. So point number one that Rav Soloveitchik is making is that both Yaakov and Yosef practiced Judaism in exile. That Yaakov might have wanted to say, I've got the excuse, I was downtrodden and I was poor, right, as an immigrant. That's, I can't practice Judaism. That's no excuse. Yosef might have said, oh, I was so close to Karovla Malchut. I was so involved in state affairs. I was so wealthy. I had to run my palace and everything that I couldn't practice Judaism. Neither of them said that. So neither of those are good excuses. And, you know, of course, looking at you know, Jewish history, you know, as immigrants, you know, sometimes we've been wealthy, sometimes we've been poor. The point that Rav Soloveitchik is making is that in either instance, you have to remain faithful. Second, Jacob had to manifest his heroic quality in a backward country. Haran was pastoral camp. Joseph demonstrated his heroic action in the most advanced civilization of antiquity, Egypt. So again, you might have thought that, well, I've got an excuse, you know, I was in some undeveloped country for 3 years. That's, you can't expect me to have practice Judaism there. The answer is yes. Or if you're in the, you know, the upper echelons of society, you also have to practice Judaism. I think that's a very, very important and meaningful passage in Rav Soloveitchik. So in any event, Yaakov Avinu got ready for his meeting with Esav, sent lots of gifts. That's, as Chazal tell us, he prepared himself latfilah ladaron v'la milchama, to pray to Hashem, to send gifts, and to wage war if necessary. A teacher of mine at school, Rav Sasson Chai Abraham, Zichron Oliv Rachai, always used to say, Dvar Torah and Parashat Vayishlach, used to speak about the three G's. Yaakov, I'm sure I've said it before, but he used to say it every year, so I can say it every year. That Yaakov Avinu used to prepare himself for three G's. God, gifts, and strategy. That's the third G. But that's the three-pronged fork that we always have to have. That's and then the night before his encounter with his brother, we have the famous episode of Yaakov's struggle with the unidentified Ish, which was clearly an angel from Hashem. We don't know much more about this angel. Yaakov tried to find out what his name was. The angel wouldn't identify himself, wouldn't tell us what his name was. That's lots of discussion in the commentaries about what was the symbolism of this encounter. That's, you know, was this Yaakov fighting with a representative of Esav? Was this Yaakov fighting with a representative of himself? What message was Hashem trying to communicate with him? Let's look at the Ramban. Okay, so the Ramban says as follows. V'amru b'vreshit rabba. So they, he's quoting the Midrash. Midrash in Bereshit Rabba. That we're told in the Pasuk that Yaakov v'yigab chaf yirecho, that the Ish touched the cup of Yaakov's thigh, v'teka chaf yerech Yaakov, and he dislocated the thigh socket of Yaakov, v'hava ko'imo, when he struggled with him. So the Medrash says, Naga b'cholat tzadikim she'atidin liyot mimenu. That's what's the symbolism of touching him by the thigh. That's the thigh means near the reproductive organs. And what he was showing was that he was, this was him coming into contact with, that's all the tzadikim and the future generations that were going to be born from Yaakov Avinu. Zedorosh shel shmad, and this is a hint that's about the future Doros Shel Shmat, generations when Jews are persecuted. So he could have just hit Yaakov, and then, okay, Yaakov would have been persecuted. But seeing as he hit him by his reproductive organs, he was saying there are going to be times not only when you are afflicted, but also when your descendants are afflicted and persecuted. Everything here is hinting at what goes on and what's happening in the future. Ad she ye karov l'karkea beit satan. That's there's going to be a generation, a time in the future of Yaakov's descendants when Esav will have the stronger hand, so much so that they'll almost be wiped out. This is like the generation of Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava in Mishnaic times. K'mosha Amru, as the Medrash says, Amar Rabbi Kiaba Abba, Im Yomar Li Adam Ten Nafshechal Kudushat Shemo Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's, if I'm told that I've got to give up my life for the sanctity of Hashem's name, Ani Notein, I'll do so, Vashe Yarguni Miyad, so long as I get killed immediately. Afal B'Doros Shel Shmad Eini Yachol Lispol. But I can't stand the notion of being persecuted throughout my life. What we see is there was a notion, of Dorosh El Shmad. There were times when Jews were persecuted. Umahayu Osim B'Dorosh El Shmad. That's what happened in times of persecution. Hayim Ravin Keduriyot Shel Barzel. They would bring iron balls. Umalabin Otam Ba'or. Heat them up in the furnace. Umatin Otam Tachat Shichehen. Umasiin Nafshotehem Mehen. They'd put them into their armpits and that would kill them. That's very painful, it sounds. There have been times when we've had worse than they've done that to us, or worse. And we know that's true. And we've borne all that, we've suffered all that, and you know what? It's past. As we see later on in the parasha, Vayavo Yaakov Shalem, that Yaakov came Shalem in one piece. That's, there's all these tribulations. We see Yaakov in the parasha fighting with this angel. We see him, his encounter with his brother, that he gets wounded in the encounter with the angel, but ultimately, Vayavo Yaakov Shalem, Yaakov emerges in one piece. And that's a message for us, a prophecy for us, that, they're going to be hard times, but ultimately, that everybody will survive. So that's Yaakov's encounter with the angel. We know then that he encounters his brother Esav. That's seems to go well. But Yaakov and Esav invites him to come and live with him. Yaakov says, I'd rather be separate. And I think this is perhaps an important message, an important model for us, in the sense that, we have people in the world that we don't see eye to eye with theologically, religiously, etc. That's in terms of morality. That's we've got to live and let live, but we don't need to live alongside them. That's, Yaakov met with Esav, they shook hands, they even hugged each other, kissed each other. Maybe there was a bite, maybe there wasn't a bite. It was cordial. And then they went their separate ways. I don't know, when Yaakov made a bar mitzvah, did he invite Esav? I don't know, doesn't say so. Doesn't say he did, doesn't say he didn't. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
He made lots of bar mitzvahs.
Indeed. If you use the same caterer all the time, you probably got a discount.
Just one living room.
But the point is, it wasn't a close relationship. It wasn't an antagonistic relationship either. And maybe that's the way that we need to be with Edom. We don't need to be hugging each other all the time. We don't need to be fighting either. There is that middle ground. So anyhow, Yaakov travelled on his way home. And Yaakov travelled, we're told, to a place called Sukkot. Vayivin lo bayit, he built himself a house there. Ulemiknehu asa Sukkot, and he made huts for his cattle. That's Alkein Karashemet Shemam Akom Sukkot. And that's why he called the place Sukkot. I didn't give you that pasuk there. According to Chazal, he was there for 18 months on the way home. Now, if you look on the back page for now, I've got a passage here from the Chidah. The Chidah, Jerusalemite Sfardi sage from the 18th century, very prolific writer. And he's getting his head around why are we told this in the first place? Like, you know, fine, he went to Sukkot and then he went on to, you know, verse 17 of chapter 33 is Yaakov went to Sukkot. And then verse 18 is Vayavo Yaakov Shalem ir Shechem, that he came in one piece to Shechem. So if it's necessary to tell us that he went to Sukkot, then all well and good. Tell us that's the route that he took, and then he went on to Shechem. So why do we need to know that he built a house there and that he made huts there? And who cares that he made huts for his animals? And even if he made huts for his animals, right, why call the place huts? Right? If he made a house for himself and his family, he'd call it house. Why huts? That's the question of the Chidah. Let's see how the Chidah addresses it. Third line, Kadmonim Achazutzar. Early commentators were in a pickle about this. The Havale Likrot Shem Amakom Beit Yisrael. He shouldn't really call the place, if he's giving it a name after what happened there, call it Beit Yisrael, the house of Yisrael. V'lasot ha'ikar yikav ha'tafel tafel. You know, make what's important and what's not important, not important. That's, the houses are more important, for the people, are more important than the huts for the animals. V'chasher hokiach Moshe ra'aya mehimna, livnei gad v'nei ruvein, she'kdumu miknehem letapam. K'moshe Perish Rashi Parashat Matot says, think ahead to Parashat Matot, where the Gad Bnei Ruvain said, you know, we'll make pens for our sheep and cities for our children. That's Moshe Rabbeinu took them to task. He says, hold on, you got it the wrong way round. Don't talk about your sheep before you talk about your children. Talk about your children before you talk about your sheep. That's so what's going on? So it might be that we hold that Tsar Balei Chaim d'oraita, there's the principle of Tsar Balei Chaim, you mustn't make your animals suffer. And that's a principle from the Torah. Nobody ever till now had worried about the comfort of their animals. And everybody just left their animals out in the fields, whatever the weather. Aval Yaakov Shleima Chashal Tzar Balei Chaim. Yaakov, he cared about the animals. V'achareshe patach mi'inkar ki tiferet adam la'shevet bayit, v'nashav v'tapav, that's uvechem v'yivein lo bayit. And therefore it says, you know, first it mentions the more important thing, that he made a house for his family. Then it chakim nusali katsami bali chaim. Then he thought, you know what? I've got a nice house. Let's do something nice for the animals as well. V'lasot lahem sukkot l'machzer ulmistor. That so make them sukkot for shade and shelter. U'mishum shehu dvar chidush. Seeing this was nobody had done it before. It was a new thing to happen. V'dikduk prati lachus al tzar bali chaim. It was something, you know, very special about him that he cared about the animals. Neged kol agoyim. Which was not what was going on in the world at the time. Alkein Karashim Mamakom Sukkot. That's why he called the place Sukkot. To let everybody know you have to be nice to your animals. That's why he didn't call the place Beit Yisrael. It's no, it's been going on for a long time that you build a house to live in. That's what everybody's done. A novelty, the fact that he made Sukkot for his animals. That's why he called the place Sukkot. Chadash Shimu Musar the Chakmu. That see this new thing, listen, and grow wise from it. So what the Chidah is saying is the reason why it's telling us this is because this was a novelty. Nobody had ever cared previously about their animals. Yaakov Avinu was the first one to come. He'd been on a long journey. He's got all these animals with him. Not only does he need to rest, his animals also need to rest. And to publicize that fact, that's why he called the place Sukkot. Now, Parashat Vayishlach in school is always an interesting parasha because even in the schools where they learn everything, that's they miss out two big chunks in Parashat Vayishlach. That's one big chunk in Parashat Vayishlach, and that's the story of the rape of Dinah. That's in the following week's Seder of Vayishev. They also miss out the story of Yehuda and Tamar. That's at a primary level. So you don't get so they don't study much the story of Dinah. That's there is the question. There is the Rashi mentions that why was Dinah violated in this way? So Rashi says Rashi builds on the Medrash that says that Yaakov took. That's his wives, Vachadas Hayiladav, and his 11 children, and he took them across the river. And Rashi asked, Dinah Heichan Hayitav, where was Dinah? And the answer is, Dinah was in a box. So why was Dinah in a box? Sorry. So Dinah was in a box, Rashi says, because Yaakov didn't want Esav to see her and want to marry her. Other Mepharshim say, Dinah just isn't mentioned, or she was a baby, says someone, he was carrying her, whatever it was, you don't need to talk about Dinah being in boxes. That's, then the question is, there are two questions on that Rashi. One is, I think very fundamentally, Rashi makes that Yaakov suffered by having Dinah raped. That's, Dinah suffered by having Dinah raped. That's, a question that needs addressing. The other question is, why on earth should Yaakov have married Dinah off to Esav? Dinah, was his daughter, and Esav was his wicked brother. You don't want Dinah to have to marry his wicked brother. Well, he was doing a tova to his daughter. He wasn't denying his brother something. He was doing a tova to his daughter. So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky addresses that question. Basically, what he says is that Esav was the best of a bad bunch. Esav was bad, but there weren't many good people around. There was nobody else to suitable to marry her off to, and that's why he should have married her off to Esav. That was the best he could get. At least Esav was his from his family, rather than marrying her off to one of the local Canaanite population. That's exactly what Yitzchak didn't want to happen to Yaakov. That's exactly what Abraham didn't want to happen to Yitzchak. So that's Yaakov also should have married off his daughter to a family member rather than to one of the locals. Okay, we know what's happened. Dinah was raped. Hamor ben Shechem said, "Listen, I'd like to marry her, and we'll have this treaty between our peoples, and we can intermarry, and we can do trade, and everything's going to be wonderful. You come and live with us." And Bnei Yaakov said, "Yeah, sounds like a good idea, but you've got to circumcise yourselves." So they circumcised themselves, and then on the third day, Bnei Yaakov came and massacred the whole city. So lots and lots of questions here. I want to really focus on the question, why was the whole city massacred? That's, for another time, we've got other themes that can be addressed. But, why was the whole city massacred? So I want to share with you just a couple of answers. Let's start with Rav Zalman Sorotskin in Osnaim LaTorah. He said, they killed every male. It says, the commentaries labor to demonstrate why killing all of the men of Shechem was permissible. I myself would hesitantly venture to suggest that Shechem's crime was not that of an individual against another individual or against God, but a crime of an entire nation against another nation. Jacob's sons seem to be emphasizing this by saying, he committed an outrage, a nevalah, the Chinovala Asab Yisrael, by laying with the daughter of Jacob. Shechem's lying with Jacob's daughter was not just a sin against an individual, but against the entire Jewish people. That's in terms of, you take Yaakov Avinu's daughter, rape is always a terrible thing. But there can be multiple messages involved in it. And here there's multiple, when you take the leader of the people and violate his daughter, that is saying not only do you not care about that person who's being violated, but you don't care about the whole nation. You're humiliating the whole nation by showing them, this is what we can do to your leader. Think about what we can do to you. We think nothing of your leader, Kal Vachomer, we think nothing of you. And therefore, it wasn't just avenging one person's honour, but it was avenging the honour of the entire people. So that's what Rav Zalman Sorotzkin says. Let's just look briefly at a couple of other possibilities. The Baalei HaTosfot have a very interesting approach. At the end, when Yaakov Avinu says, you've put me in a very difficult situation, you've sullied my reputation, the Hainamru, and they responded, what can we do? Hakazona Yeaseh. That's Yaaseh Tachotenu. Should our sister be turned into a harlot? It's not quite clear what answer were they giving. Yaakov says, how could you destroy the whole city? This has sullied my reputation. And they say, no, she was turned into a harlot. What's that got to do with the whole city? Still, why did the whole city have to be destroyed? So we could say that in actual fact, this is what Yaakov said in the first instance. So he violated her. That doesn't mean the whole city is at fault. As Amrul, they said to him, certainly, if only Shechem had violated her, that would be one thing, Micha. Aval kulam shechvu etzla, sheratzu liyot nimolim. The fact that everybody agreed to become circumcised means that they all actually were raping her. Zeshama katuv asher timu achotam. That's why the pasuk says timu. They defiled their sister. Not just he defiled their sister, but the whole people. So what the Baalei HaTosfot are saying is, in actual fact, it wasn't just Shechem. It was Dina became Hefka and passed around by everybody. She was a captured woman who everybody could please themselves with. And that's why everybody was killed. Presumably the Baalei HaTosfot are kind of working backwards, extrapolating from the fact that everybody was killed. And there's no apparent reason for killing everybody. It must be that everybody was doing to Dina what Shechem was doing to Dina. And therefore they all deserve to be killed. So that's the approach of the Baalei HaTosfot. The Or HaChaim gives another answer. Same question. Kashema lama yagu mishalochata. Why should innocent bystanders be killed? And also, why, if you look carefully at the Pesukim, why didn't they start by killing Chamor, and then killing the people? If you look in the Pesukim, you haven't got them in front of you. In chapter 34, verse 25, we're told, they killed all the males. Verse 26, we're told that Chamor and Shechem benohagul ficharev. Chamor and Shechem, they killed as well. Well, start off, if the perpetrators, start off by killing Chamor and Shechem, and then go on and kill everybody else. So back in the Or HaChaim, Achein hinei b'nei Yaakov lo haya b'yadatam laharog ela balaveira. In actual fact, Shimon Levi b'nei Yaakov, they only wanted to kill the people who were guilty. Ela shekol b'nei ha'iratzu lamod b'feretz kenegdam. Everybody was trying to stop them getting to Chamor and Shechem. Leval yargum al gham, so their king wouldn't be killed. Al kein hargum midim rodef. Therefore, they had the status of a rodef, a pursuer, and therefore they could be killed. And they were using themselves as, either they were protecting them, or they were being human shields, whatever it was. But they were standing in the way. Hu omro vayagu kol zachar. That's why it says vayagu kol zachar. First they killed all the males. Uvaze hisigu laroget chamor ve shechem. That's how they were then able to kill chamor and shechem. Otherwise, they could never have got to Hamor and Shechem. So, you know, if you're standing there protecting them, then we're going to have to kill you as well. It wasn't so much that everybody deserved it. According to the Baal HaTosfot, everybody deserved it. That according to the Or HaChaim, it wasn't that everybody deserved it in the first instance, but once they were supporting the infidel, as it were. So then they all had to be eradicated, so the infidel himself could be eradicated.
Maybe it was a time where they were all just rotten, and it was the sort of place where you could just rape a passing.
Yeah, that's also possible. Yeah, definitely.
That's the culture there.
Yeah, definitely also possible like that. Okay, so that brings. I want to say it brings Parshat Vayishlach to a close, but it brings our share on Parshat Vayishlach to a close.